Hello?
Hello?
Yes, Randy, yes.
Yeah, how you doing, buddy?
I'm good. How are you, sir?
I'm fantastic. I love this phone number. It's a good, easy to remember number. Not that I'm going to call you every day.
That's okay.
You know, it's a fun number. I like
it. It is. Yeah. I got lucky, I guess. Yeah.
Cool. So you're back in Kansas City, and what's the plan?
Well, to be honest, I'm not sure exactly. I had a couple of family members die in the same exact week on the same day, unfortunately.
Wow.
So I'm here for right now just to be with my family. And yeah.
Good. Makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Let me know what you want to do and when you want to do it and how long it should run.
Well, this will run for about 4 hours. No. We're,
three and a half of them will be without me.
Yeah. No, it's going to go for about 30 to 45 minutes, honestly.
Okay.
Just to give you the premise of the show, it's a motivational podcast about going after your dreams, talking about the circumstances along the way, how you handled them, and where you are today. You're actually, Randy, my third interview today that I've done.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you're a trooper. You'd be out of breath. Who'd you do today?
Well, I know that you're not much of a sports guy, but Coach Dan Reeves from the Dallas Cowboys.
Good.
Yeah. And then I interviewed a baseball pitcher for the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. Well, not quite there yet, but he's going to be. He got drafted by them. Kenny Rosenberg. That's his. That's what it is. So now I'm on to my favorite one of the day.
All right. Well said.
All right. Are we ready to go?
Yep.
All right. Here we go. In 3, 2, 1. Hello, everybody, and welcome back once again to the Great Scott Podcast. Today, I am joined by TV personality, author, ex-game show contestant, announcer, and let's see here. What else?
So, yeah, what else could I do between all the other things?
Yeah. Oh, and a radio disc jockey. That's what I meant to write down here.
There you go. I did that. Yeah. Yes, I did. That's why radio is in a sad state.
Oh, no. Come on. I'm sure it wasn't that bad. I'm sure it's not that bad to me.
No. But I'm happy to be out of it and doing what I love, which is, something you talk about often, about doing what you love and being motivated to stick with your dreams.
Absolutely. And just to hit real quick on the radio thing, I hear from time to time, I'll listen to Howard Stern, and he said even back then it was hell to do radio.
Mm-hmm. We worked the same radio station. In fact, I was fired on a Friday, and he came in Monday. So I guess he replaced me at WRNW in Briarcliff Manor. And it was working conditions and the pay sucked. But you know what? If you had a creative bug in you, it was a fantastic opportunity to, create on a canvas without somebody over your shoulder, generally speaking, micromanaging what you were doing. So it was a great stepping stone for a lot of people, Jimmy Kimmel and thousands more, who learned how to relate to an audience through trial and error.
Absolutely. I was just you hit the nail on the head on what I was going to say. I mean, a lot of the game show hosts who are unfortunately not working anymore or are deceased now came from radio. I think the only two left are like Pat Sajak and
all of them. Bill Cullen and Bob Barker and Sajak and Alex Trebek did radio and everybody. It's a great place, as I say, hours a day to learn how to relate to an audience and how to put words together to form sentences, which, unless you're doing it, is difficult. Like by counting the number of times I go, that gives you an idea.
Yeah. I think you should have been a comedian, Randy. I really do.
Well, the stand-up is too tough on the knees. I was going to do sit-down comedy.
Okay. All right.
In fact, I did sit-down comedy. I really did. I got a squatting ovation. See, this is the kind of humor that's kept me out of the big time. Yeah.
And also, speaking of it, you've gotten to announce for, as far as game shows go, some of the biggest names. I mean, some of those people are people you actually got to announce for, like Bob Barker and Carney Wilson and Wink Martindale, Chuck Woolery, and the list just goes on.
Dick Clark, Chuck Woolery, you mentioned. Yeah, I've been fired from a lot of places.
Oh, man.
Now, shows end, they come and they go. Some of them are just 13-week wonders. And the thrill of it all is knowing that there's another one coming. You're not always sure, but somehow it just seems to work out that way. After 20, 25 years of another show just always materializing, you start to lose the fear of, I'll never work again, you know.
Right. So did you have, so basically Fred Westbrook, am I saying that name right?
Well, it's official. His real name is Westbrook. But people couldn't say it. It's Dutch, I think, in ancestry. So he would just say Westbrook. But he'll answer to anything as long as there's money involved.
Okay. Yeah. So to me, Fred is Mr. Game Show, since he was the one who got these people the jobs, going from job to job to job, like Tom Kennedy and Chuck and Wink and all those guys.
Yeah, but we grew up in New York, didn't know each other then, but we're both attracted to game shows, sat in audiences, and where I got to know the announcers, he was thrilled in getting to know the hosts. He was backstage with Bill Cullen and a bunch of these people, and in later years, when he had the opportunity to work in game shows, he was a contestant coordinator, booked me on a bunch of shows, helped me get a few bucks and Lee Press on Nails, and was going on to be a producer when he got the opportunity to become an agent to replace Jay Stewart, who had been an agent briefly for Don Pitts, who was one of the great talent agents. In any case, he didn't want to do it. He thought I'd be producing game shows. That'd be more fun. But ultimately, I and a few other people convinced him to be an agent, and that's when he was able to turn tables and return the favor to all these great hosts that he was now able to book into the next generation of their jobs.
Now, you had mentioned Jay Stewart. This is something that Monty Hall did not quite like talking about, but toward the end of Jay's life, and I know that Jay was a agent for you. Right. Before what happened, and I'll let you tell the story, because I think you tell the story a lot better than I would.
Well, which story is it? His life story, the sad demise.
Yeah, the sad demise. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Jay was, first of all, he had been a huge star. Well, I can't say a star like Jack Benny, but a star within the network radio realm. He was well known and could be entrusted to do any number of shows. He was, what would be the sports analogy? A good player, a standby, an all-purpose. Give me the sports analogy. You're a sports guy. Reliable. When you figure it out, call me back. Because I love that you're sports knowledgeable, and I'm really not. I don't have that gene. But in any case, Jay was very respected as being a player who could handle any challenge at any time. And unfortunately, his life went through some difficult changes. His daughter committed suicide, and he took to drinking and gambling, and the escapes that people unfortunately turn to. He was far from alone, the first or the last. And his drinking ultimately took him off the air, and he became an agent. Don Pitts, whose name I mentioned before, gave him the opportunity to use the contacts he'd made over the years among the network executives and producers to book the next generation of talent. And he signed me and many other people and was getting us some work, but it was challenging to him. It's a sales job, and it's not necessarily an audience applauding. It's mostly hearing no, like any sales job. And ultimately he found himself unsatisfied. I saw him on a Friday afternoon at 5:15, I was in his office, and he looked at his watch and said, "Randy, I got to go to Casa de Cadillac, pick up my car. They close at 6, call me Monday. Have a great weekend. Okay, Jay, talk to you Monday. Bye-bye." And Sunday night, I found out that he'd ended his life with a gun at his home. And it was very, very sad. He had been depressed. You could see that he was suffering from that great malady that many people do but few talk about, and he took his life. And Monty got the phone call from Jay's widow, and did come to the home and was very giving and emotionally in that difficult time, because he and Jay had had a wonderful partnership. They'd had some rough patches, but the details of which are in the forthcoming book I'm writing now. They had a few difficult years, but the love and respect between them was deeper than any of that. And frankly, Jay would have been surprised that Monty came to his home to be with his widow. I don't think he felt that their relationship was as strong still as it was. Mm-hmm. So it's a difficult story, certainly, for Monty to tell. And I'm going to put a lot more of it in the forthcoming book, because it's a story that needs to be told for not only fans of game shows, but also for people who may be suffering or know someone who is suffering with depression or other emotional battles.
How is it that that you found out about Jay's passing?
Well, Fred Wasbrock, ended up with Jay's job after the fact. So I was still with the agency. Fred and I had been friends. He had booked me on game shows. I came down. We went through Jay's desk. There were notes from his calls and attempting to get people's work. I have that now because I wanted to give it a home and have an opportunity to see what Jay was facing in those final weeks, because his notes are quite extensive about, you know, who he spoke to and what the outcome of the phone call was and all of that. And of course, between Jay getting the information from Monty and what Don Pitts had learned from Jay's widow, we were able to piece the thing together.
Yeah.
So Monty was a lot more forthcoming with, a trusted friend and a colleague, Fred, as he would be with an interview.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of game show announcers, there's one in particular that really did help you get to where you're at today, at least on the track to game shows as far as announcing goes. And you wrote a book about him here within the last, I think, 4 years ago it was that you wrote the book. That. Yeah.
Yeah, the great Johnny Olson.
The great Johnny Olson, absolutely.
It's a name known by people who aren't even game show fans. He was that popular. Johnny had been a radio host for many, many years before television. He was tapped to be the host of an experimental television show in the 1940s, early 40s. And when television came in, he was host for shows until the business started to mature and it was now more competitive to have a hit show. So he was getting a little older and relegated from the host position to be the announcer on shows. He was respected and admired, but he didn't have the look anymore. And most people, here's where I really came to develop a real respect for Johnny. Many people who have been hosts for 20, 30 years and were told, you know, you no longer serve the purpose well, and we'll give you announcer's job. A lot of people would be like, hey, screw you. You know, I was here. I've invented this thing. You want to relegate me to, you know, forget it. But Johnny said none of that. Johnny got served some lemons and made lemonade. He made himself irreplaceable and even more respected in this subfield of game show announcer and audience warm-up. The two jobs were always combined in the early days. And when it came to getting an audience to be at their most excited and reactive, nobody put on a show in the studio audience more energized than Johnny. I mean, in middle age, he was turning cartwheels, literally turning cartwheels in the aisle, and had an amazing, amazingly exciting and fun warm-up act. And I fell in love with what he did there more so than his announcing. But many people who have heard him over the years, this is Johnny Olson speaking for Mark Goodson, Bill Todman. He had a clarion, crisp, clean sound that was perfect for early television. When that tiny little speaker, you know, was sometimes distorting of audio, he just rang clear straight through. And my God, he could read scripted copy without an error. It seemed amazing. It was quite unusual to watch him work in both realms, announcer and in audience warm-up.
And like you say, I mean, just to piggyback on what it was that you just said, I mean, you can, whenever you watch Match Game or The Price is Right, you can just tell the audience is really into this. I mean, they are energized. They're ready for Gene or Bob or someone to come out, and they're just into the game. They're focused on it.
Yeah.
And that's
because
of Johnny Olsen. Yeah.
And it was amazing because, you know, I first watched him do that act in New York, and I remember very clearly the first time I saw him, a show called Snap Judgment, hosted by, my goodness, I think it was Ed McMahon.
Ed McMahon, yep.
Thank you. And, you know, New Yorkers got into the studio on a cold day with coats in their laps, and New Yorkers don't have a necessarily outgoing, friendly reputation. So here are all these strangers who were, you know, have their arms folded. They've been standing outside in the cold weather for an hour, you know. And out comes this guy, and he starts to giggle and laugh and sit on people's laps and give away dollar bills and kiss old women. And all of these strangers suddenly were like family. You turn to the person next to you and, you know, give him the elbow. Wasn't that funny? You know, this is someone you wouldn't be talking to 30 seconds earlier. And he could turn a crowd into a family. He could take a bunch of strangers and herd them like cattle and turn their attitude around to where they cooperated with whatever he would want from them. You fell in love with this guy, and his energy was so enthusiastic. There was a lot of thought, too, behind what he did. You know, when I got to know him, first he put me in his act, which was quite interesting. I learned how to improv with the best. You know, go get me a cup of water. You know, next thing you know, I'm off getting water for him, and I don't know whether to come back on the stage or not. Where's that kid with my water? I guess I should enter now, you know, and he's engaging me in conversation and physical comedy. And that was quite amazing to see it from the inside out, to be on stage working with him. When we got to be closer friends, I found him to be a really wise, astute analyst, if you will, of the human condition. How, you know, like a psychologist, how can he do what it was he was trying to accomplish? There was a lot of thought behind it. It all seemed to be giggles and laughs, but a lot of thought. And I'll give you an example, because people always say, what the hell are you talking about, Randy? Well, I'll give you an example. He would introduce some of the crew members and indicate that they were, first of all, like family. Oh, we've been working together all this time. And then he starts to talk to the audience members like they were family. Now, what's your name? Is that Bob? Look at Cousin Bob, everybody. Cousin Bob, where are you from? You know, and he put this relative, Uncle Jim. Now, tell me about that. Did you know anything about? And he'd find out one of the audience members is a butcher, let's say, and turned out, in talking with audience members, another one of them maybe owned a restaurant, I don't know, or like to eat. Hey, you look like a man who enjoys a good steak. Where's our friend Uncle Jim, the butcher? Yeah, there you are. Now tell him about the best kind of, and next thing you know, he's got these people, what can I say, cross-pollinating, you know, strangers now talking amongst each other, and we're all family members. There was a lot of thought behind what he did, and it was exceptional at it. And the book, Johnny Olsen, A Voice in Time, reveals all of his tricks of the trade.
And that book has done quite well for you as well, I've seen.
It was my first writing, first attempt at, you know, full authorship. I've done magazine articles and stuff, but this 400-page book, it did quite well and has spurred on a career where I'm writing a second book now, all about great crazy moments on TV sets, not the one you have in your living room, but the set of a show where the craziest stuff has happened, flakes and flukes and feuds and felonies and just wild moments. It's a great bunch of history.
And just to mention, Johnny Olsen also had like a 6-decade-long career, which you don't see anymore, even on television.
That's
maybe
true.
Maybe in movies, movies, but not on television, that's for certain.
That's for certain. Yeah, you're, you know, hot and cold. You look at a long career now, you point to somebody like Ryan Seacrest. You know, guys like Alex Trebek and Pat Sajak, who've been doing this for 40 years, these guys, the likes of which will not be seen again. Because
right.
No one in sort of the future, if they weren't already doing it, let's put it this way, if they hadn't already been fronting a successful show for 20 years, they would not have been hired 20 years into these shows run. Same with Bob Barker, who would have hired Bob at age 85. You know, it's just that he was there and still doing it. But as these shows eventually disappear, or the hosts eventually disappear, I don't think you'll find anybody, I'm agreeing with you now, that has that kind of longevity, a career of 50, 60 years.
Right, absolutely. And since you mentioned the name Bob Barker, how is Bob doing? What's he up to these days?
Well, he's up to about 6 feet when he stands, but most of the time he's in a wheelchair because of the falls that he's taken. He's had some damage, but at age, what is he now, 97, I want to say? Let's see, he was in 2003, he was 80. So in 2013, no, that can't be right. Well, I'll get back to you on that. I think he's 96, maybe 97. What a hell of a run. He still has most of his marbles. His physical strength isn't what it once was, but at 96 or 97, my goodness, he's doing fantastically.
So he is able to keep a conversation going and understand.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Yes. Roger Dobkowitz talks with him. Roger was a producer for 35 years with him, and talks with him regularly. And I talk to Roger, and he's doing fine. He's home, not getting out a whole lot. But again, 96, 97, my goodness.
And also, go ahead. I'm sorry, Randy.
No, just truly amazing.
Yeah. One thing that I saw about Bob is that his house that he lives in is a historical landmark. It has a plaque on it stating that this is a historical landmark.
Yes, his home is in the area known as Outpost Estates in Hollywood, just north of where the retail, you know, section is up in the hills. And this Outpost Estates area was built by an architect who's since become noteworthy. And these homes are now classic in their design. However, most of them had been over the, 60 years or so that these homes have been standing, have been remodeled, many of them, and therefore they've lost their integrity. However, Bob's, he maintained it, found the architecture to be, you know, noteworthy and didn't want to make any significant changes. So his is among the few, if not maybe the only one, that was able to earn landmark status because it hadn't been adapted and remodeled.
And yeah, so is that the house that he's always lived in?
Yeah, since he came, I'm trying to think. Certainly since he started working Truth or Consequences, would have been the late 60s. So he's been there now for, since the late 60s. My goodness, that's a lot of years, like a lifetime.
Absolutely. So now, I know that I've been talking a lot about your game show colleagues, but let's talk about you, Randy, now.
Well, I was born at a very young age.
Right.
The doctor slapped my mother.
And... yeah, that's some old comedy routines right there. That's like Kenny Young thing kind of stuff.
Hey, yeah. It's so old, it's new. I grew up in New York and fell in love with radio disc jockeys. And when I found the college radio station, I figured, wow, this is cool. Maybe I could aspire to be a radio disc jockey. And at that same time, I was still cutting classes to go down and watch Johnny Olson, who by this time was a friend. He'd see me in the audience and put me in the warm-up, or even selected me to be a contestant on What's My Line, which he did at the time, because they were looking for an added contestant they were running short. In any case, I still, in the back of my mind, thought what he did for a living was spectacular, but I didn't dare dream about ever doing it, so I got into radio. And seeing Johnny, he said, that's great, you're in radio, this and that. And he gave me, inspiration and motivation and told me I could actually do the job he's doing. Nobody could ever do it as well as he did, but he encouraged me to get to know producers, go to their run-throughs, get on shows, be involved, hang out with the people. And through his encouragement, I graduated in dreams from the thought of maybe being on the radio to being on the radio until I could get into television games, which happened for me in about 1990, when I started announcing television shows.
So it had to be kind of a surreal experience for you, because there you are on The Price is Right, which you've done quite a few episodes with Bob, and you're standing there right where your idol once stood, yeah. And you're getting to announce for the most famous game show host that there is.
It's just unbelievable. I mean, it's cosmic symmetry, whatever. Here's this guy who encouraged me, was my mentor, the whole reason I'm in the business. And then I get to stand where he did. And I'll tell you, to give you a little bit of the in-between, between 1990 and when I was doing that in the early 2000s, Johnny had passed away in 85. His wife, Penny, was put in a nursing home in 1999. At that time, I'd never spoken to Penny. However, I received a phone call from his nephew. They had no children, so the nephew was the next of kin who was closing out their home. Johnny had passed away. Penny was going into a nursing home, and they found boxes of memorabilia and also some letters that I had written Johnny. And they found me, however they did, because there's a million Randy Wests in the world, but called me and said, "Are you the Randy West who corresponded with Johnny?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, we have things that he saved over the years. We're cleaning out the house. We don't know what to do with some of this. Would you be interested in giving it?" I said, "I'll be right over." They said, "Don't do that. We'll send it to you." And I got several boxes of Johnny's collectibles going back to, my goodness, the 1920s and 30s, where there were press clippings and family photos, as well as microphones and scripts and everything from his background. So when I got the job at The Price is Right, I showed up day one wearing Johnny Olsen's CBS badge, his identity, a security clearance badge, hung it on my sport jacket, and had a few other lucky trinkets from Johnny in my pocket. His business card and other little things. I walked in, was introduced to everybody, and I said, "Well, no, don't tell me. You must be Barbara Hunter. You must be," and they were amazed because I named, almost everybody in the green room. And I said, you don't understand what this show has meant to me. I showed them Johnny's badge, and they just went, "Where? How? Wow." And I went out, did that first day, that first show, at the end of which Roger came to me. He said, "Did you realize that we were all kind of standing off in the wings?" I said, "Yes, frankly, I was nervous. I was doing audience warm-up. Roger was watching me because he was my boss." And then somebody joined him, and a couple of people joined them. And I was starting to get self-conscious, looking out of the corner of my eye, thinking, "Am I in trouble? Why are these people watching me so intently?" I'd done other shows, other jobs, and nobody gave much of a care of what I was doing, just working the audience. Well, Roger explained to me at the end of the show, "We were all there watching you, and what got said was, my goodness, he's channeling Johnny."
Mm.
And I kind of laid the foundation for that by, having his badge and things like that. But what they said to me later was, you really were inspired by him. It was not watching his act, it was watching his style. And of course, that's where I learned it. So it was no surprise to me that what I was doing was reminiscent of what Johnny had done. Again, his jokes were corny for his day, wouldn't play that well now. So I wasn't using his material, but the style, getting down in the audience, handing out dollar bills to people, making similar jokes, involving these people, playing that, "Now where is Tim? You said that you were, whatever," the things that he did were deep in my heart and my mind, and were part of the act that I did. So when Roger said to me, "We all thought you were channeling Johnny," that was the supreme compliment.
And one thing that I found amazing is that when Penny had called you, you said that he had saved everything that you had ever written to him inside of a box, and he had all this memorabilia, and there was your letters right there that you had written to him.
He had saved things that were important to him, and not all of it, things I would say, but they had special meaning to him. A plaque from, first of all, his Emmy plaque and other major items like that. But he had different pieces from events where he was celebrated. He used to go back home to Windom, Minnesota, and Cottonwood County back there, and they made him, honorary whatever, and he led the parade at some, centennial. And he has, artifacts and memorabilia from those events, which I'm sure were very meaningful to him.
So you say that you're writing a new book now. How's it?
It's too wonderful. It's 140,000 words, and it needs to be 120,000 words, and it's impossible. I'm sitting with it right now, when we called each other, trying to find places and stories and things I could take out, but it's all just stuff that I would love to read and hate to have to pull out of a manuscript. So it's up to me now to get it down to a publisher's, you know, manageable size, and I'm having difficulty. I'll just have to take a hacksaw, you know, and hack away at this thing.
Yeah.
But it's wonderful, wonderful stories about, and, you know, not just that so-and-so was a wonderful person and he was so talented. It's crazy stuff that has happened on the set. When you do, you know, you're Johnny Olsen, or if you're Bob Barker, or if you're Alex Trebek or Pat Sajak or Dick Clark, all these people are in the book, Chuck Woolery. They're all people that I worked with and have watched and been present for some of the thousands of shows they've taped when crazy things have happened. You know, there's no shortage of wild stories. For example, somebody who's wanted by the FBI shows up as a contestant on Password. He's recognized, and the FBI calls Mark Goodson Productions and says, "This man is wanted. Do you have any information on him?" "Well, we're going to mail him a check." "Well, don't mail it. Have him come in for the check. He won $56,000. "No, have him come in and we'll stake out the offices." And indeed, this guy showed up to collect his check instead of having it mailed, and the FBI nabbed him in the Mark Goodson, Bill Todman's offices. Crazy things like that. And people who were present for these things have shared their stories.
Wow. I cannot wait for this book to come out.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you another quick story. I worked a show called 21, which was a remake in the year 2000. Of a show that NBC owned that had been embroiled in the game shows, you know, scandals. 21 was rigged in the 1950s. It wasn't in 2000. But to make the show spectacular for prime time, they used to bring cash onto the set so they could cash out the winners with cash. Now, they never got to take it home because the rule is it's paid by check after 90 or 120 days. But it made for good television when Lieutenant Legler of the U.S. Navy won $1,876,000. They gave him $1,876,000 and change in cash. Now, this wasn't play money, which blew me away. This wasn't stage money. This was real cash, which was delivered every tape day. $2 million was considered to be the biggest number they would ever need. And indeed, they got to $1.8 million, as I mentioned. Cash was delivered in armored trucks, moved by forklifts onto the stage. It was unbelievable. It needed to be unwrapped and displayed. And then at the end of the day, since they got all the winnings back the minute these people left the stage, $2 million to the penny had to be accounted for, restacked, rewrapped, forklifted back onto the Brinks trucks and taken away. What an amazing bunch of work for silliness. They could have taken a shot of play money or put a dollar bill or a $100 bill actually on the top and bottom of a stack and call it a stack, you know, of money. But they had $2 million. Now, let me tell you, when you bring 500 strangers into a studio that has $2 million in it, everybody's on edge because they're only 15 feet away from the money. And there was an amazing event that happened. Security guards, as many as we had, armed security guards, there was an event in the audience that appeared to be a diversionary tactic. I'll just say that. And the guard started to run up to this diversion. And then the thought came, maybe this is all something to draw security away. And then security all turned around and ran back. It was crazy. There was $2 million with armed guards. And in those days, people in 2000 did not come through metal detectors. It was pre-9/11. There were no metal detectors. So who knew of these 500 audience members, what they might have been carrying and what their motive was? For $2 million, people will do strange things. And, I'll leave it at that. The story is played out in the book, but one of the most amazing things I've ever seen.
So is there a estimated time of arrival for this book?
Well, I'd like to have it out for Christmas, but it's up to me to do this editing. And of course, the publisher determines the schedule for releases. So while I may think I'd like it for December, who knows? It's too early to know.
Right, absolutely. So, Randy,
yeah, I will come back on the podcast with you though, and
absolutely,
and tease, and maybe give away some copies.
Absolutely. So, there's one final question I wanted to ask you, and I always ask this about every guest, no matter what they do. I mean, I've had chefs come on. I just interviewed a football coach, an NFL football coach, and this is something I always like to end with.
Mm-hmm.
What advice would you give to someone who wants to get into your kind of business?
Don't. And then if the answer is, if the answer is no, I have to, you know, if it's show business or shoe business, go in the shoe business. There's a lot less heartache. It's a lot easier, you know, but if I say no, don't do it. And you do it or need to do it or want to do it or are going to do it anyway. Well, then that's the first hurdle. That means you are really driven. And you need to be, because you hear more no than yes. There are very few jobs compared to the shoe business, for lack of a, you know, or butcher, or even sports celebrity. There are just a handful of hosts, a handful of announcers who work over and over and over again. If you want to be part of that, you need to be extremely motivated. You need to take each no and say, yeah, that just made it tougher. I like that. It's like running a marathon. Give me another mile. Come on, test me. You know, it's like, I'll give 5 more minutes in the gym because I really want to sweat. And if you can turn the no's into motivation, and you really want to do this, then don't give up on those dreams, because everybody has a story to tell of when they were just ready to cash it in, suddenly fate turned. You know,
absolutely. So, I mean, I think of that Peg Entwistle, I think it's her name, the one who jumped
Peg
off.
Peg Entwistle jumped off the H of the Hollywood sign.
And she got a letter in the mail stating that a studio wanted her for a job, too.
Yep. Quite amazing. Quite amazing.
I know.
And I'll give you a story that relates to something we were talking about a moment ago. When Jay Stewart took his own life, he might have, well, though he thought his career was over, it might not have been, because one of the pilots he did before he passed and before he was retired from the business was a pilot for a primetime syndicated Jeopardy.
Oh.
Yeah. And you know what? That show is still on the air.
It is.
Imagine if he had not checked out, he had done the pilot. There's no assurance he would have gotten the show, but who's to say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But Randy, I look forward to hearing when this book comes out, and like you say, come back on and let us know.
I'd love to. And I'm so happy that you've started up this podcast, because you got a lot of good things to say and a heart that likes to share positive thoughts. And I'm very, very happy to be among your guests. So thank you.
Well, bless you, Randy. Thank you so much for saying those words. And I'm honestly deeply humbled. And I know we've been friends for quite a few years. And I absolutely do, honestly, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for all those years of friendship.
Oh, you got it, Mike. Have a great, great day.
You too, buddy. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.